Eric strategically gave me the last epic time change. So I know everybody's feeling a little different, but we'll try to get everybody warmed up real quick and do some participation. This is part two of Passover, part of our Jewish Feasts and Festivals class. Passover had a lot to say about it. It was the first actual piece that we've been diving into all the particulars of it. So there's a couple things we want to say about it. What I want to do before I start with my piece is do a quick review. Somebody give me a quick summary of what was the Passover event. Quick summary.
The Jews were in captivity. They didn't like it. God brought plagues on Egypt and delivered Israel out of Egypt.
Yeah, he delivered them out. This Passover event. What was the actual Passover? What happened?
On the doorpost and that Passover,
what
their
Passover?
First
angel of death.
Yes, there we go. Yeah, angel of death.
And so the firstborn lived if they had the blood.
All right, that's good. And then what did God tell them to do after this event? What happened? Where did they go? They fled. Yeah, exactly. They fled. They were gone from Egypt for forever, I guess, for the most part. Now, I want to do a quick exercise. So just imagine that for whatever reason we need to start observing Passover again today. You need to do these things that we just mentioned. If it was the first one, we put the blood on the door. After that, we're getting out of there. You have to take up everything you have. You have to eat unleavened bread for a amount of time. Get it out of your house or the bread beforehand. You have to do all those things. What are some things that you would have to overcome, some obstacles? Like, why would this be difficult? What are some things that may be a stumbling block for you observing this the way that you should? I'm going to try to write these down.
Well, first of all, I might have to get a lamb.
Yep, get a lamb. Get a lamb. Be rich enough to afford lamb.
I have.
What else?
Get rid of all the leaven in your household.
Yeah. Get rid of leaven. Who in here would that be a problem for today? What else? What about the timing of it? Will the timing be difficult sometimes? Who in here has to work evenings sometimes? Nobody? Man, we got a fortunate class in here. Well, timing may be an issue. I'm going to put that on there, even if no one here has a problem with it. It's the timing. Sometimes if you're working late, or maybe you've got a job, and you got to take off time to observe this and do it the right way. We're bringing this forward to today, I know, but think about some of those things. Or anything else? Were you about to say something? Okay. So what about how you would deal with guests? What would you have to do with guests during this time?
Well, they'd have to be circumcised.
You'd have to tell some people.
That
close. Tell them to be circumcised.
Question answer session.
Whatever. Would that be awkward for him? I mean, like, I've always just breezed over that. Like, yeah, it's something you have to do, but I imagine for people who were not circumcised, who were not part of God's people, that was kind of a weird request to make. If you want to be part of God's people, this is one of the things that you need to do as part of this. What about the guests that have nothing, they don't want to have anything to do with it? What do you need to tell them?
They can't participate.
Tell them no. Yeah, they can't be part of it. Tell people no. Some people have no problem with that. Some people do. I hate telling people that they, oh no, you can't do that because this is why. I always feel uncomfortable doing that. Do you think any of these things were a problem for the people directly after this first Passover? I want to kind of exclude the first one because of the extraordinary events of that time, but next year, next year. Do you think any of these things ever came up and started becoming a problem for them? I guess you see the point. It's kind of a rhetorical question. Is, there'd be a real chance that I would mess this up somehow, in some little way at first. And God's instructions, they require something from us. It's not nothing. And it's not for us to look at how the Jews messed this up over time and kind of turn up our noses like, how could they? Look at these amazing events. If you've ever been in one of my classes on the Old Testament, you know that I see very little difference between the Israelites and us today. not reading about some alien race who did nothing but mess up. We're reading about human nature, our human nature that exists today. And I just think it's kind of a high form of arrogance to think, we're not like that. We wouldn't do that. Obviously, I'm about a part of this event. So look for yourself in these stories. Did they not observe Passover correctly? Well, why not? Have I ever made mistakes like that? Let's look at it. So that's what Passover is. That's what we're going to do in this class. We're going to make a couple of observations about the who, what, and when of Passover and see how the prophets use Passover event and their imagery and draw a couple of lessons out of that so that we can be better Christians today. Because that's what we're doing in this class, right? To know God better and serve Him better overall. Okay, so one of the first things that I want us to notice is when this was observed. Passover, it pops up in times of transition. Now, we all know the Jews have a very tumultuous history, in and out of slavery, exile, in and out of their own land. And it's at these points, these transition points, that the writers include the observance of this feast. Now, I'm sure it was observed more times than just these four, maybe not many more times, but more times than this, but these are the times when it was deemed important to write down, for us to remember. So everybody turn to Exodus 12, and we'll stay in there for just the first part of the class. We'll put some context for this. And down at the end of the chapter, I have a heading that says, Institution of the Passover. And it says that God was talking to Moses and Aaron, and He gives them some specific instructions on who's able to participate and how. And then it says something at the end that I want to hone in on. So, Clay, can you read just verse 50 and 51 of Exodus 12?
Mm-hmm. All the people of Israel did just as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. And on that very day, the Lord brought the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their hosts.
All right, so who did just as the Lord commanded?
All.
Everybody. All. And what happened that very day?
They were delivered.
That very day they were delivered. So all of this stuff happened in that very day. All right? So I forget a lot of things, important things, but do you think any of them ever forgot that day? So no. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to make a distinction here. We're going to say remember and forget several times in this class. And I think you need to really draw a difference between what it means to remember something academically, which we all remember a lot of things academically, and what it means to remember it in the way that you act and observe these things. So I think they all remembered the day academically forever. But did they remember it in the way that they treated that day going forward? Those are some of the things that we're going to bring up. So this is one of those memories that would imprint forever. And I'm told you to remember things better when there's this multiple sensory input. You see and hear, you hear and smell, taste and touch, all of that. Those things are easier to recall. So I kind of want to think about that day for just a second. Think about what they were doing. What did they see that day? What are some things that they saw? We'll write these down too. Put yourself in those shoes for a minute. What did they see that day?
Blood on your face.
Blood on the doorpost. You think that made an impression on some people?
Blood.
That's not something you see every day. It signifies something. What does it mean? How did that blood get there? Something had to die. What else did they see that day?
They saw a lot of screaming and lamenting of the dead of their family members.
I'm going to put that in here.
And the people from that nation, they mourn very differently than we do. I think for the most part, Americans, even Jews in here, are kind of ashamed to be seen, really crying out loud in public.
But they're not over there. It's a very observable thing. They fall down. When you see the sackcloth and ashes and all the observances of grief from the Bible, there are cultures today that still express their grief in ways like that. Not so much us, but think about this. You may have seen that physical grief. Anything else that you see or heard that day? I think, so they went later that day to places they'd never been. What were the Israelites in Israel? They were slaves. Were they taking field trips to all the places around? I'm sure they went for some reason at some point, but these were new lands that they were seeing when they left out of there. They saw Egypt from a different perspective for the first time, the outside looking in.
Well, just all together, I think that that would be an interesting thing to be as a crowd, a group of people. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you're all coming out of your houses, right, and you're moving toward leaving, and that would be like a mob scene kind of view.
Yeah.
That would be interesting.
And how many people was it? Do you remember from the text? Yeah, at least a million. It's 600,000 men, so whatever that means, however big their families were. A good guess is around 2 million or something like that. Maybe about 2 million people all together. Maybe you've been to Mercedes-Benz Stadium or whatever. Was it hold like 70,000 something around there? Mm-hmm. 2 million people. That's a lot of people to see. I got kind of a funny image in my head. Some of them probably saw like grandma on a donkey for the first time riding out of there. They're seeing like everything, get their whole house get packed up, you know. They're seeing very different things, memories that would have stuck with them, that would have attached to this overall memory of Passover and what they were supposed to be doing. They heard those cries in Egypt, just to kind of stick with you.
They apparently saw jewelry and gold from them given to them.
That's right, yeah. Something they probably didn't see a whole lot of before that one. So jewelry and gold, something very new and different. They also saw Moses take something out of the city. What did he take out of the city?
Bones of Joseph.
Yes, exactly. The bones of Joseph. I'm sure not all 2 million saw that, but I'm sure the people that did, that made an impression on them. Seeing their ancestor, this person that everyone knew, this was their forefather, you know, coming out, and however they did that. These are all images that were stuck with them, all right? So people would, good.
And the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire.
Yeah, they saw that a few days later, whenever Pharaoh caught up with him, whenever his heart changed. And yeah, I'm sure that's the overall thing, too. Good. So the people, they're never going to forget that day. This was the day that Passover was instituted, right during this incredible transition. I'm sure there were some bad apples in the 2 million people, but I bet there was a lot of hope in that crowd. A lot of thanksgiving, a lot of relief, a lot of joy, a lot of wonder at the things that they're seeing. And it would have been a time when the people drew close to God, fell close to Him, and observed the Passover with great attention in this first one, right? Well, let's look at some other transition points. Can somebody turn to Joshua 5? We're going to read verse 10 through 12. Joshua 5. Before we go down the line here, David, go ahead.
While the people of Israel were encamped at Gilgal, they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month in the evening on the plains of Jericho. On the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. And the manna ceased the day after they ate of the produce of the land. And there was no longer manna for the people of Israel that they ate of the produce of the
land. Yes, it just came into Canaan. Think again about this point of transition, about how some of the way the people would have felt towards God on this day. This was a good day. Perhaps some of those things, feelings that we just listed, hope and thanksgiving, relief after a long time of turmoil, closeness with God. Nate, can you turn to Ezra 6? We're going to read verse 19 to 22 out of Ezra 6 as another transition point. Ezra 6, 19 to 22.
And the descendants of the captivity kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month. For the priests and the Levites had purified themselves. All of them were ritually clean. And they slaughtered the Passover lambs for all the descendants of the captivity, for the brethren, the priests, and for themselves. Then the children of Israel, who had returned from the captivity, ate together with all who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land in order to seek the Lord, God of Israel. They kept a feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy, for the Lord made them joyful, and turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them to strengthen their hand in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel.
Now, what does this one really hone in on, the word that he said? How were they feeling this day?
Joy.
Joyful, right, good. This is when, you know, they're coming back from exile. This was a joyful time. Again, closeness with God. The people are feeling what this Passover event was about, drawing closer to God and understanding Him. The last one I want to look at, Danny, is 2 Kings 23, 21 to 23. That's the last one.
Then the king commanded all the people, saying, "Keep the Passover to the Lord your God, as it is written in the book of the covenant." Such a Passover surely had never been held since the day of the judges who judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. But in the 18th year of King Josiah, this Passover was held before the Lord in Jerusalem.
Good. All right. Again, a transition point for the people. This being during the reforms of Josiah, and we're going to focus on something about this passage here in just a second. But first, I want to ask the first question from your lesson. In each of these accounts, what was Israel transitioning from and to? I'm going to write this on the board. They're transitioning from something and then to something. And so, give me just some terms of what they were transitioning from into.
Slavery to freedom.
Yep, there we go. Slavery to freedom. What else?
Sojourning to rest.
Yep. Sojourning to rest. Good. What else?
From Moses' leadership to Joshua.
There we go. Leadership. I don't think it's kind of a middle. It kind of encompasses both. Change of leadership.
Well, in Joshua, they came from a band of people to a new nation.
A band of people to a new nation. Yeah, yeah.
Or a group of people.
Yeah. Huge nation.
Syncretism to exclusivity.
Okay, I'm not
right. Well, in several of the accounts, there's the circumcision in Joshua, the purity in Ezra 6, and in 2 Kings 23, the emphasis on there's never been a feast like this. That they're sort of saying, okay, we're done being like the nations around us. We're gonna belong to God and do it His way.
Yeah, I'm gonna sum that up as unfocused to focus. They kind of bring in where they had been to a very focused people and thought process.
I think like Josiah is like from idolatry to a focus on God, because the passage before that is talking about them purging all the idolatrous things there.
Right. So the whole idea of just not being part of God's people to being part of God's people in the way that they observe what they're supposed to be doing. We have pain and suffering, hard work and homelessness and servitude and darkness, being lost, frivolousness, whatever, all of those things too. Rest, freedom, ownership of something, abundance, restoration, and purpose. And at the end of this passage in 2 Kings 23, it kind of has some troubling facts. How long had it been since the people kept Passover?
18 years.
Yeah, at least how was it supposed to be kept? It'd been a long time. You know, Hezekiah, of course, being the first one to give a try at that.
Yeah, and the sad thing about it, even after Josiah, God had already made up His mind they were going to go into captivity.
Exactly, and you know, the thing that blows me away with Josiah is how did Josiah know that they should be keeping Passover?
They found the book of the law.
Found it. Yeah, like it wasn't just something that they knew about. Like, what is this? What's this? Look at the law and figure out that they need to be keeping this Passover. You know, look at what they had forgotten. I wonder if some of them actually did remember that was something that happened a long time ago, but, you know, that was so long ago that we don't think about that anymore. Enough people have stopped observing it that I don't need to observe it either. You know, it's very easy to feel close to God in these times of transition when they were transitioning into abundance, when He gives us rest, when He restores us and gives us purpose, bless us with things that this life that are good. But we kind of forget that in those in-between times when it's not happening. You know, I know this is a class on Jewish feasts and festivals, we're wanting to learn about them, even though we're technically not observing them anymore. But what are we doing if we are not seeing things that we can improve on? in the examples from the Israelites. Has it been forever since something really nice happened in your life? Well, remember what God has done for you in previous times. Are you transitioning to a hard part of your life? Remember God in that part as well. I'm very encouraged by the older generation in this congregation here, because they show me that you can remember and serve God for as long as you're here. And that may seem like a small thing. We're all here 80, 90, however many years, something like that. But, man, it's easy to forget and to get lazy and to sacrifice our morals just one time in that long stretch, and it can send you down a really bad road. But I like to see that there's so few here that have that vigor, that they don't lose that, and you can remember things. I want to observe the things that God's asked me to remember Him as long as I can. What was one of the main purposes of Passover? Remembrance. All right. Each of these passages listed here, on the questions, say things like, do this because that's when God brought you out of Egypt. Do it at night because that's the time that you came out. So we need help remembering, James.
It makes me think about how today there's so many that say the Bible's outdated, so it's not necessary to remember what God has said. But it's so important, as God is teaching us through all of this, that we do remember that His Word is always relevant and that it never passes away.
Right. So. Good point.
Just that the bitter herbs is also supposed to have help them remember the harshness of the slavery, and then the rest of the festival, just the joy of the deliverance. And so I think the remembering has kind of two aspects to it. Right. I think sometimes we get nostalgic about our past.
Yeah, good, yeah. Nostalgia, but also remember the hardship of it. Okay, so what was Passover? Hold on, before I do this, look at this awesome title that I came up with here. Proper Passover Participant Provisions. I got a little bit of a piece there. Liberation at its finest. This is what we're going to talk about, all right? What? Who was Passover not for? Who could not observe it? Yeah, the uncircumcised. Who else?
Unclean.
I heard something else.
I was going to say, generally speaking, that would be Gentiles.
Yeah. Effectively, Gentiles, for the most part. Of course, there were provisions made. That's what we're going to talk about. But, workers that didn't have anything to do with God, like hired workers, those who fail to keep it. So even Jews who just don't keep it for whatever reason, and they don't have a good excuse, they are cut off from God's people. What do all of those groups have in common? Gentiles, foreigners, hired workers, uncircumcised. Who do they not have a relationship with? They are separated from God. There's a separation. That's why they're not observing it. It's primarily a Jewish thing because they have this special relationship with God already, but are there provisions for any of these groups that we just mentioned? What about foreigners who want to partake? Slaves and hired workers have a kind of part of the family, if you will. Any man can become circumcised and partake. Unclean, they can wait and do it the next month. A provision was made for that. Those who miss because of travel may also take the following month. Eric got the ball rolling on this a few classes ago, but doesn't this show a God who understands the people He has created? A father who knows his children. Things happen, and he makes provisions for those people. And there's two groups that I really want to focus on here, the first being the people that miss because of circumstances. So I'm going to read a passage from Numbers 27. And forgive me, if you've been in one of my classes before, I've used this example several times, so I really like it. Numbers 27, verse 1 through 11 here. This is the daughters of Zelophehad. Okay. So then drew near the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh. So the names of his daughters, he does that. And then they stood before Moses and before Eleazar the priest and before the chiefs and all the congregation at the entrance of the tent of meeting, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness. He was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but died for his own sin. And he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be taken away from his clan because he had no son? Give to us a possession among our father's brothers." Moses brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord said to Moses, "The daughters of Zelophehad are right. You shall give them a possession of an inheritance among their father's brothers, and transfer the inheritance of their father to them. And you shall speak to the people of Israel, saying, If a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. And if he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the nearest kinsman of his clan, and he shall possess it. And it shall be for the people of Israel a statute and a rule as the Lord commanded Moses." Did God's original instructions on inheritance include this scenario? They did not. But once circumstance led to this, provisions were made. All right? Now keep this in your mind. This is the first part of the story. We're going to move over to Numbers 36, 1 through 9, where we see the conclusion of this, I guess. So Numbers 36, verses 1 through 9. The heads of the fathers' houses of the clan of the people of Gilead, the son of Machir, son of Manasseh, from the clans of the people of Joseph, came near and spoke before Moses and before the chiefs, the heads of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel. They said, "The Lord commanded my Lord to give the land for inheritance by lot to the people of Israel. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. But if they are married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the people of Israel, then their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of our fathers and added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. So it will be taken away from the lot of our inheritance. And when the jubilee of the people of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry, and their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers." And Moses commanded the people of Israel, according to the word of the Lord, saying, "The tribe of the people of Joseph is right. This is what the Lord commands concerning the daughters of Zelophehad. Let them marry whom they think best. Only they shall marry within the clan of the tribe of their father. The inheritance of the people of Israel shall not be transferred from one tribe to another, for every one of the people of Israel shall hold on to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And every daughter who possesses an inheritance in any tribe of the people of Israel shall be wife to one of the clan of the tribe of the fathers, so that every one of the people of Israel may possess the inheritance of his fathers. So no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another, for each of the tribes of the people of Israel shall hold on to its own inheritance." All right, so this is the aftermath of that first passage that we read. If these daughters get an inheritance that wasn't originally theirs, then they marry into another tribe, that tribe will take that inheritance, which effectively brings them back to where they were before this provision was made. They had no inheritance. And again, God's like, "You're right. Here's what you do." So there's a few observations that I want to make from this. First one's obvious. Does God make provisions for his people?
Yes,
absolutely. Not in every situation for every bizarre circumstance, but here is established precedent that God will change his instructions in response to circumstances. He is an active participant in a relationship with us. A second observation. What do the people do when they feel something isn't right in these examples?
They turn to God.
They turn to God, all right? They don't just do whatever they want. They're not like, he didn't account for this. Let's just do this thing that sounds right. They go and ask God. Moses is like, "I don't know. Let me ask." And he gets an answer. And the second one, it doesn't say that explicitly. They ask, but it says, Moses commanded the people of Israel according to the word of the Lord. They go to Moses, who goes to God. They don't just do whatever they think. I think you can make a great parallel with us going back to the scripture today. When we have a question, where do we go? Do we just try to answer it with like, I've gained some wisdom over these years, maybe I can answer this. You may even get pretty close on your own. But it's good to go back, search the scripture. How do you handle this weird situation? What does the Bible say in similar matters? What precedent is there? What similar context? What's the heart of the matter? The people ask God and he answers. Third observance here is, do God's provisions stay within the confines of the intent of his original instruction? Are they wildly different, or are they still in the same vein, still intent? Yeah, they still have the same original intent. I think our horrible internal logic sometimes tells us that if you can't find the exact answer, then you basically just make it up and do whatever you want. That's something I don't think of consciously when we do this. You were talking about the class that you had on logical fallacies, and there's like a website out that lists out, it's like, I don't know, 30-something logical fallacies. They all have names, like a straw man, where somebody builds up a fake argument and then tears that down to help make their point. There's a lot of different ones like that. And this is one of those where you, if you don't know, if you don't understand, then you just separate yourself from it and use that logic to move forward. But that's not how we should do it. God provisions, they work towards the original intent of the inheritance instructions. And then I think this is of the utmost importance, okay? When deviating from the original instructions, sacrifices have to be made, all right? Who were the daughters of Zelophehad allowed to marry? Anybody?
In the tribe.
In the tribe. It had to be in the tribe. Only men were there. Do you think that was a bummer to some of them? They may have had their eye on somebody else, seen another clansman that was nice. I'm sure it was not great for everybody. Do you think there was a temptation to sidestep this instruction for at least some of them? Maybe I'll marry somebody else and just won't have kids and it won't be a problem. But down in verse 10 of chapter 36, you see that the women did as the Lord commanded. They followed these new instructions. Sacrifices were made, certainly, but God provided. So bringing all of this back, it was kind of a lengthy side story, bringing this all back to Passover, we see that the same type of provision is made for people in circumstances that prevent them from partaking of the appointed time. You have to do it the next time, which means you're probably going to have to make some sacrifices. If you were traveling, you better make sure you're not traveling next month. You're going to need to plan around that, but God gives a way. Right? And it's really important to see that precedent. The second group I want to talk about here is for Gentiles. We're kind of grouping in everybody at this point is Gentiles. Do you see here that at the very beginning of the old law, we see God making provisions for Gentiles? This concept that seems so new to the Jews in the time of Jesus was as old as it gets. They're making provisions all the way back. We're not going to dive in to all of that in this class, but there are countless examples of this in the Old Testament. If you wanted to be a part of God's people, you could do so. It only took the will to do it. And Passover is a perfect microcosm of what is taught by Jesus. Being a Jew does not guarantee your relationship with God. If you miss Passover for a not good reason, then you are cut off. God does not want a relationship with those who do not want a relationship with Him. But if you do, here's what you do. Jesus gives us instructions of what we do, just as God does here for foreigners and slaves and workers and anybody who wants to partake. Do you have any thoughts on that before we do?
We talked about this a little bit last class, but for the Gentiles to partake in these things would have meant that they would have had to start learning what we now call the Old Testament stories. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true for New Testament Gentiles, that this becomes their heritage. And so the expectation, even of like in 1 Corinthians, where it's Jew-Gentile audience, the expectation is that those Gentile Christians will start learning these stories, because this is their heritage. So just the importance of the Old Testament.
Right. And so my sister is a proselytized Jew. She married a Jew in a Jewish family. She felt that was important for her to become part of that heritage, if you will. And there is a huge thing that you have to do to be considered a Jew in that way. She had to take a big test, learn all about the heritage, every story, know why they call things the things they do, learn all the words that they do, when they observe things. It was something that took over a year to accomplish for her to do that. So, like, that idea is there. Of course, I don't recommend doing that today. It's not something that you need to be doing. But there's at least the example there of this idea of learning another heritage. Any other thoughts before we move on? Okay. In your lesson, we talked about the Passover lamb. Anytime you need to describe something in as few words as possible, what do you include in your description? Minute details? No, only the most important things come out, all right? What your audience needs to know, the things that best summarizes what you're describing. So in the case of Passover, what would be one detail that you would usually include if you were describing the feast later? The Passover lamb. This is kind of the thing that helps everyone understand, okay, yeah, that's what you were doing. This is the centerpiece of this thing. not only because it was the main course of the meal, but because of the significance of it, you know, what it stood for, as well as the emotional effect, perhaps, of killing a lamb. I try to bring some of these stories into today to help us understand a little better. What's something that a lamb has in common with a dog? How do you think of them both?
Dogs can be a pet.
Yeah, well, they can be a pet, yeah. And these pets, they seem innocent and you love them. And, I mean, they're just pure. This lamb, this Passover lamb is pure. My dog, not all dogs are like this, I know, but a lot of them are. They're so innocent. They act really. You know, I'm pretty sure none of you have killed a lamb, or if you have, there's only a couple in here. How many of you would look forward to killing a dog every Passover, every year? This is something you guys do. It's part of the instructions. Now, killing animals was a much more common thing back then. Everyone was much more close to that process than today, with huge farms everywhere. But I don't want to make it seem like this was just nothing to them. They may not have been all weepy like I would be, seeing a dog get killed, but it was not nothing to them, killing this Passover lamb. Killing a big ugly cow was one thing, but I think the people recognized the difference and the significance of killing the lamb. How many of you from the lesson ran a search for mentions of the Passover lamb in the Bible? And if you did, how many did you come up with?
I don't know. I didn't do the thing. I think it was about Jesus, the biggest.
Okay.
The biggest.
Yeah, yeah. That's the big one that you want to focus on. Did anyone have like a number?
Twelve,
yes. What version were you looking at?
ESV.
ESV, okay, yeah. So it was around 12. About half of those are coming across those 35. But it was found in, we'll list these off, Exodus 12. I put these on the board. No, that's for this. Exodus 12. Of course, we know what happens there. That's the institution of it. Passovers and issues. That's when we read about it. 2 Chronicles 30. We alluded to this earlier. That was when Hezekiah makes this first Reformation attempt. So he seeks to restore Passover. 5 chapters later, we see Josiah and his extreme Reformation. That's the other mention. And then Ezra 6, which is, you know, the return of captivity from Babylon. It's mentioned once in Mark, once in Luke, both referring to Jesus observing this meal with his disciples. So in the Old Testament, when Passover is observed, the Passover lamb is mentioned as part of that observance every time. It was an important part of the meal, and Paul tells us why, as Ken just alluded to in 1 Corinthians 5. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Cleanse out
the unleavened. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate not the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. You see how this statement from Paul says the same thing that Jesus
discovered during his ministry. It points to something that everyone knew from the old law and says that was all pointing to something. And it was a point to that. And now you know what it is. And it seems very obvious now. But that lamb didn't just have the immediate significance of remembering what God did by delivering the people from this horrible death, bringing them out of slavery. That was very significant. But it also looked forward to Christ, who would be their ultimate sacrifice, the one that would have to be made every year. The sacrifice that covered all sacrifice. And I think that language throughout the Old Testament would have really helped drive this point home when people read this from Paul. Which brings me to the last part of this class, where we're going to talk about images in Isaiah. So we're going to focus on this one prophet here. Alright, so we're going to do some reading here in this last part, so I really want to look at it. Isaiah does something where he recalls the event of Passover into the minds of his listeners and readers to help illustrate his prophetic statement. As we've mentioned already in this class, it's good to appeal to the senses when you're getting people to remember something, multiple things, and bringing up this event would have done so.
Historically, Isaiah was preaching during the time of Hezekiah and had some interactions with Hezekiah, who also brought back the Passover. And so it would seem to fit the historical context of him saying, hey, you remember what we just did? Like, there's going to be something greater than this.
Right. So, really good point for the timing of that. All right, so let's read a few passages from Isaiah. I know this is a little small. Dave, are you able to read this?
Sure.
Here? So we're kind of jumping around. Well, not on this one. This one's straight. So can you just read everything you see up here?
In that day, the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal for the peoples, of him shall the nations inquire, and his resting place shall be glorious. In that day, the Lord will extend his hand yet a second time to recover the remnant that remains of his people, from Assyria, from Egypt, from Athros, from Cush, from Elam, from Shinar, from Hamath, and from the coastlands of the sea. He will raise a signal for the nations and will assemble the banished of Israel and gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. The jealousy of Ephraim shall depart, and those who harass Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not be jealous of Judah, and Judah shall not harass Ephraim. But they shall swoop down on the shoulder of the Philistines in the west, and together they shall plunder the people of the east. They shall put out their hand against Edom and Moab, and the Ammonites shall obey them. And the Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt, and will wave his hand over the river with his scorching breath, and strike it into seven channels. And he will lead people across in sandals. And there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant that remains of his people, as there was for Israel when they came up from the land of Egypt.
Thanks, Dave. Now, does anyone know what this passage is foretelling? What's it looking forward to?
The Messiah.
The Messiah. And a time when more people are going to be brought in. I think the running theory is that, well, this falls under a header in my Bible of the righteous reign of the branch, right? The branch being Jesus. And it's generally thought this is when the Gentiles are given this gospel message. They're bringing people from the four corners of the earth, brought into an understanding of God. So let's look at through this passage. Where do you see imagery that may remind you of the Passover? Good, yes, this part when they're going across. Yeah, that's something that happens right after Passover. They leave the land of Egypt and they've gone across in sandals across dry ground. This is something that would have been remembered.
In verse 14, there's the plundering.
Right, good, yeah, the plundering, something that they did when they left Egypt. What else?
In verse 11, the Lord will extend his hand, which he did.
Yes. He did in a way that was very physical. You can see the way that he extended his hand. Good. What else?
Judgment from the, on the oppressors.
Mm-hmm. Yes, judgment on the oppressors, where that is on Egypt. You know, like jealousy of Egypt. Yeah, 13. If I get 13, it is just be part of those who harass Judah shall be cut off. Good. I had verse 10 and 12. We have a signal for the people, a signal for the nations. You know, Passover, that symbol. That's good for what was to come. Verse 12, you have the dispersed in Judah. So slaves in Egypt, they had been dispersed from where they originally came from. And we already mentioned verse 13. 15 and 16, yeah, we've got all of those. So let's look at one more in Isaiah 49. Here, I'll read this one. So this one does kind of jump around. We go to verse 1 and 14, and then again. Listen to me, O coastlands, and give attention, you people from afar. The Lord called me from the living. From the body of my mother, he named my name. And then it jumps down. But Zion says, the Lord has forsaken me. My Lord has forgotten me. And jumps down again. Thus says the Lord God, behold, I will lift up my hands to the nations and raise my signal to the peoples, and they shall bring your sons in their arms, and your daughters shall be carried on their shoulders. Kings shall be your foster fathers, and your queens your nursing mothers. With their faces to the ground, they shall bow down to you and lick the dust of your feet. Then you shall know that I am the Lord. Those who wait for me shall not be put to shame. Can the prey be taken from the mighty? Will the captives of the tyrant be rescued? For thus says the Lord, even the captives of the mighty shall be taken, and the prey of the tyrant be rescued. For I will contend with those who contend with you, and I will save your children. I will make your oppressors eat their own flesh, and they shall be drunk their own blood as with wine. Then all flesh shall know that I am the Lord your Savior, and your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. All right, what are the people lamenting here? What do they think the Lord did to them?
The Lord had forsaken them, forgotten them.
They think that he forgot them. Right? And then, what do you see in verse 24 that looks like the Israelites in Egypt here? Can the prey be taken from the mighty? Yes. Will the captives of the tyrant be rescued? Yes. The answer is yes to those things. Did you also notice a common phrase in both of these passages that we read? What would be raised? A signal, all right? Yeah. Does God let us know what we need to know? Yes. What if he hadn't said anything about putting the blood on the doorpost? You know, like Eric said in the last class, did they deserve some of these same things that the Egyptians got? Does God expect us to do things for him or serve him, observe things that he'd like us to observe without us knowing what it is? No. He gives us a heads up. He gives us chances. He gives us a way to come to him willingly. And that's where I'm going to come to the very last part of this in Isaiah 18. So y'all actually turn it here because I don't have it on board. Isaiah 18, I'm going to read verse 3 to verse 7. 18, verse 3. All you inhabitants of the world, you who dwell on the earth, when a signal is raised on the mountain, look. When the trumpet is blown, hear. And you go down to verse 7. At that time, tribute will be brought to the Lord of hosts from a people tall and smooth, from a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, whose land the rivers divide, to Mount Zion, the place of the name of the Lord of hosts. I mean, he's saying, pay attention to what God reveals to you and has done for you. Remember those things. And your resting place is going to be Mount Zion, where God resides. Passover was an event that helped the people remember and have a relationship with God so that they could be with him on Mount Zion in this ultimate fulfillment of what Passover is about. Do I have any more comments on that? That's all I have for this point. Okay, good. We only have like 30 seconds left. So